Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
At last, it's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. Gather around the table this Thursday, we've got Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
Danielle Riendeau.
Hi, hello.
How did you pronounce that last name?
It was very French. It was a very French way of pronouncing it.
You know, I was having this thought the other day. I was
Riendeau.
Like, It's Riendeau. But I have a hard time. The problem is, it took me so long to master the correct pronunciation spelling of any word ending in E-A-U that, like, I end up just maybe making your name
Frenchier.
Sorry,
I feel like now I've, like, deeply embarrassed you. I apologize, Rob.
No, like, that's like, let me explain to you the origins of that spelling, the Latin. And we also have Natalie Watson in some kind of studio.
Somehow, at great length,
after great pain.
Yes, shout out to Kato, the fucking champ of getting me set up to record today. It was a struggle, but
here we be.
He's our champion, and here we be.
Thank you, champion.
Was the solution the trash can in the end?
No, the solution in the end was the original...
Resetting everything
and going back to the original thing we wanted to do. I think the TV fried temporarily Kato's sound card, and then now it is alive again. So shout-outs to Resurrection.
All right.
Thank you, Jesus, praise, the TV.
Yeah, yes. Praise Resurrection, praise Jesus. All right, so our first waypoint for this week is something we've all been watching. It has sort of taken the internet by storm, and that is, of course, tidying up with Marie Kondo. And Natalie, this was your waypoint to begin with. Why don't you tell us a little bit, for the handful of people who have not come across the takes yet, what is Tidying Up with Marie Kondo?
So Tidying Up with Marie Kondo is a produced by Netflix series. Made by Netflix.
It's got the Netflix logo.
It's got the Netflix logo on it. Who knows? Consisting of about 8 episodes, I believe, in which Marie Kondo, who is a New York Times bestselling author known for her book, The Art of Tidying Up,
she had to tidy the mic.
I had to tidy the mic. You know what? Now I've finally sparked joy.
Everything about this recording has been joy sparking, let me tell
you. Yeah, you know, it sure has. So she wrote this book called The Art of Tidying Up. Originally, she was a consultant for people who needed her organizational skills. And then because her wait list became so long that she decided to write this book so that it could reach a wider audience. And after that, a couple years later, they came out with, I don't know how long, but they came out with an illustrated version of that book, which is called Spark Joy, I believe. And then this show, which has just come out recently, within the past month or a couple weeks, actually, because time is not real. And I was first introduced to Marie Kondo because my father
gave my mom the book and was like, for Christmas or something, was like, here you go. And my mom was like, got the message.
And I'll say that's like, that's a gift and also a judgment.
Happy for sure. Wife, happy life.
So this was pre-divorce.
This was... I don't know at what point this actually happened, if it was pre my parents' separation or...
Because if that's a gift you give your ex for Christmas, It could have been.
I mean, it's complicated.
You could still be a better person. Slide this across the table.
It's complicated.
There's still time for you, too.
My
so what is this method? Why is there's a million books about how to organize your stuff more efficiently, organize your life, be more efficient. What about Marie Kondo? Like, why do you think Marie Kondo connected so much with people? What is her method?
I mean, it's fascinating because my boyfriend actually sent me like Google Trend of or Google search trend or whatever of the phrase or like the term Marie Kondo in the past 4 years, and it only just spiked like this in the past couple weeks. So previously I know that she was like on Good Morning America, I think she's like done sort of the promo circuit after her book came out, but I don't think she was, I mean, she definitely wasn't a meme until like
not
the
a household name. It's probably someone that you know, some people like, yeah, I feel like the, you know, the organization lady, like, you know, yeah, like you could kind of scratch at your head, but like,
I hadn't
actually knowing her name
before.
Yeah. I think it's something that like people encountered when talking about like sort of self-help or organizational books, because she's probably one of the names you can associate with that, and one of the more well-known names that people have that association with. But I think the thing for me, watching the show finally allowed me to see in practice what the book was about, which I think made a huge difference in actually being able to see the process and also the final result of what the method can do. And so the method in its fundamentally is not about getting rid of stuff. And I think that's a crucial part, and that's what people often refer to as sort of the magic of it, is that it's not hoarders. You know what I mean? Like, it's interesting to see the types of households that she go to, because some of them are like some hoarder-like
tendencies,
vibes.
But it's not like they're not.
But it's
like
not.
In Hoarders, which I watched a lot of that show.
I watched
when it
a
first
lot of that
out,
show too.
It was just junk food. You know, you'd find dead animals.
There's like,
I mean, like
a, yeah, there's like an
with,
unhygienic,
like, yeah,
like unsanitary thing to it. And Hoarders is like
also
my
deeply
mom
exploitative, right? Like,
yeah.
I watched it at a time where like I didn't quite understand. Like, looking back, I was like, yeah, that show was just like taking advantage of people. I mean, hopefully they end up at the other side that, you know, their lives are better.
Right.
But the way like boom, 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 like next on Hoarders, like look at this pile of shit.
But there's a reason why the majority of people you see on Hoarders are from a low socioeconomic class. Like, there is a reason why people, and this is a mentality that I grew up with, is like, we save shit because it costs more to have to go out and buy shit again. And so, yeah, my mom is going to buy like the 12 pack of deodorants or whatever at Costco and buy everything in bulk, because that, even to spend more at one time, will mean to save less in the future. And that's like a specific mentality that can lead to, you know, accumulating so much stuff that it becomes overwhelming. And so Marie Kondo differs from that, because Marie Kondo is about confronting the what you actually have, like materially, like tangibly, like what do you own? And the way that she does that is by each step of the process. The first step is clothing. The next step is not kimono. Or is the next step kimono? It might be.
Kitchen?
Oh, no. The first step is clothing. The next step is books and paper. And the last step is kimono, which includes kitchens, bathrooms, miscellaneous items, sentimental items. And so within each of these categories, the first step of the process is to arrange everything you own within that category. For example, the clothing, to pull
all of your clothing from around the house and put it in one pile in one place. And then one by one, you pick up each article of clothing and you see if it, what she, her coined phrase is, sparks joy. And it is a very, in the way that Marie approaches material things, it is about reconnecting with the sentimentality and the like emotional value of these things. Because a lot of the times people are like, well, I don't love this thing. This doesn't spark joy for me, but it's necessary. Like, it is a necessary thing. And I think there can be a little bit of a disconnect there, but she's always accommodating to that as far as I've seen in the show. But it is about taking things and really seeing, like, do these, like, do I have a connection with this thing, with this shirt that makes me feel good? Like, that when I wear it, I feel, like, a good in my core being. And then if it doesn't, it's about, she says, to thank the item for, if it's something I never wore, showing me the things that I do like. If it's something that I wore a lot but is like can no longer be used, to thank it for like the years of, you know, of service that it did for you. And I think that's, and to go one by one. And you see her like slowing down people in this process. You see her like saying like, you know, don't just toss it. Don't just like throw it, you know. No, it's like take the time to really appreciate the shit that you have, because it'll make you a more conscious person of your material possessions.
Well, and I think, like, a big part of this is, yes, it's about considering what is your relationship to the stuff. You have a relationship with your possessions. You may not be cognizant of that relationship, but I think the essence of this method is uncovering, like, what is that relationship? The feeling when you pick up a well-loved object of, I'm glad I have this. Like, I'm glad this is in my life. That sort of, you know, pleasure of a beloved book or a really useful tool you use every day that's well-cared
really comfy
for.
Sweater that, like, just makes you feel warm and fuzzy. Like, it is, like, so much of a physical reaction. Like, she encourages people to, like, think of, like, the physicality of the emotion behind the relationship.
And I think the flip side is something I found really useful is this idea of thanking objects, because I have trouble throwing away things that I once cared for a lot but no longer suit my needs, that no longer
the guilt.
Matter to me. Yeah. And the whole, like, act of, like, sort of mourning or, like, saying farewell to a thing that, like, meant something to you, it isn't going to fit with where you're going next, what you need right now. I think that's really useful. But this whole idea of considering relationships, of looking at what is your relationship to your stuff, how does your stuff affect your relationship to your life, to others, I think this is where tidying up Marie Kondo begins to become what we more classically recognize as a reality show. It's not just organizational porn. It is it is a reality ass reality show. And you know, Patrick, I am curious. You know, what did you make of that aspect of the show in terms of the way it is trying to dramatize the act of ultimately cleaning your goddamn house?
Yeah, episode to episode, it's sort of weak. I often felt like you could tell episode to episode, you know, like, where they picked families and then, like, didn't necessarily find as much to, like, sort of mine out of the characters of those people. I watched three episodes. The first episode, which is a couple with two kids. The second episode, which is an older couple who's, they're kind of like empty nesters, right? They're dealing with, like, how do we transition to retirement? And then on everyone else's recommendation, I watched, like, the sixth or seventh episode, which is about two men in a relationship who are, like, dealing with their parents, or one of their parents coming to visit, like, their house for the first time. And I don't know. The reality show part, I think, is, like, it's okay. I don't watch a lot of reality shows. I used to watch a lot of trashy reality TV, but not as much these days. But I found, like, the stories of, like, that first one about the parents with the children and the two men in the relationship to be, like, really compelling characters, where it, like, was able to, like, tightly explore their relationship with objects. Like, the more it could drill down on the relationship with the objects, the more it, like, made the whole arc of, like, kind of picking up little things that you were writing down, like, Man, I looked at how you fucking fold those shirts, and I was like, yeah, it makes sense. You can see all the shirts when you pull. That makes sense. That's an improvement all around.
Yeah.
So fuck the space. I just often wear the same shirts because they're on top. And it's like, if I had could see them all, I would wear more shirts. But Danielle, that you had like a really powerful reaction to a lot of the characters, and I'm curious, you know, especially because we don't have much time with you before you have to bounce. I wanted you to give you a chance to sort of elaborate on your own reaction.
Sure. Yeah, I had a really surprising reaction to myself. Reaction to the show, and I should go in saying I hate minimalism in general. It is for a reason.
Whoa.
It has always been associated for me with like the very like tech bro, like efficiency equals better human being. Like get
it's super
rid of all
classist.
This shit.
Yeah.
Yes. Like extremely classist, extremely like I don't even wash my shirts. I just throw them out. Like it's more efficient to just do X, Y, or Z. Like it's always been associated with that for me, which I know is a very limited view. It's just that is what
That's
got
fair.
Thrown in
That's
my
fair.
Face at enough of a formative age that I associated it with that. So I don't generally like this sort of thing, although I thought Marie was lovely. She's a compelling character. She's wonderful and compelling and, you know, fun to watch and always. I think her method seems to make sense. It actually seems like a very moderate method of figuring out what you actually need, what you actually want. So I thought that was perfectly good. But I hated this show so much, and I'm so sorry. I spent like 4 hours sobbing last night watching this show. It really deeply, deeply upset me. And I don't think it's the show's fault necessarily. I think I'm in a weird ass place in my life where I saw a happy couple with two kids and a house. And I'm about to turn 35. And I was sort of writing something about this yesterday, and I don't think it's going to happen. So I'll just say it here. I'm about to turn what is considered advanced maternal age to have a biological child. I no longer have a long-term partner. That was something that happened this year where I thought this was something I was going to have in my life, basically. And so I don't watch a ton of reality TV shows. I don't watch a ton of sitcoms. I don't watch a ton of things where it's like, generally happy people in their house with their kids, you know, like it's not really a type of media I engage with all that often, to be honest. So I sat down to watch this and I was like, all right, Marie, hit me with your best shot. And within 10 minutes, I was like angrily, jealously scrawling all the things I hated about these people. And then it kept going on. And I was like, oh no, I'm encountering some very deep, ugly jealousy within myself right now. This was the life I was always, you know, growing up in a very heteronormative society. This was the life I was supposed to have. This is the life my parents wanted me to have. And these people are terrible at communicating with each other. They need some DBT. They need some therapy. They need some fucking good-ass therapy, and they're going to be okay. They just need to learn how to communicate with each other. They need to learn to communicate needs and boundaries. And I'm just sitting there going through all of this, and then I start fucking sobbing, like truly sobbing. And I was like, this is really embarrassing. I am sobbing at this dumb reality show that is supposed to make people happy and feel okay about their lives and feel like there is some method to the madness. There are things you can do in your life to maybe make your life a little easier and to maybe make things a little better for you and your loved ones. So I basically had a midlife crisis last night. Well, thank you, Marie Kondo.
It's totally understandable though, because the reality TV framing in a lot of these episodes is there is something badly amiss in this family's life. And it is because their clothes are not properly folded and they have too much stuff. And I totally understand. Like, I mean, I think about how that show would have landed for me when I was in a one bedroom overpriced in Cambridge, like living, frankly, not quite making it paycheck to paycheck. And you know what I mean? Like all the shit that was going down. And then you're watching the show that it's a lot of couples that I would like maybe have called yuppies years ago. Like lots of people who's like, lives are going pretty well by the standard of where I spent a lot of my 20s and early 30s, where a lot of my friends find themselves right now. And there's an element of the show's like dramatizing this, you know, can they really like come to terms with each other and their clothes collection? And there's this part of me, it's like, fuck you. You don't got a problem. Like, what? You got two beautiful kids, a relationship that was only dysfunctions, or you guys are fucking it up, and a beautiful house that's full of too much stuff, and you're coming at me with, like, oh, man, we really need to address this. Like, fuck off. Like, I totally get having that reaction, and yet there's something compelling about those stories. But I totally get it. Like, that show is presenting a lot of it is the most, for a lot of these people, it's the most like first world problems, the show, in a lot of ways. And I think that is exaggerated by the way the TV production ends up heightening what are pretty bog standard like domestic tensions.
Well, I think that's where like some of these episodes are stronger or weaker, right? Like the two men, I think actually like it uses the objects to like have a larger contextual understanding of their relationship, like their place in society. Like that's, you know, of the three episodes I watched, like that was the one that was the most effective at like from beginning to end.
I hated that one.
Really? Why?
Because to me it was like they were trying to force this narrative on like
they're like loving parents that have always loved them from the beginning, like that like they were trying to build a sort of thing that was like, well, in the end, like these homophobic parents are going to walk in the door and be like, "You're not my son." That part, you're right. That part didn't work. But I think all the stuff, like the meat of it, right? Like the middle of it, when it's like the two of them going through their stuff, like the subtle tensions between them as they're going. Like I thought that stuff worked pretty effectively.
Good. But I think.
Go on.
I need to see that one. I saw the first three. To be clear, I watched the first three episodes, and like by number three, I had like friends on speed dial. I was like, "Am I a worthless woman? Is my worth as a woman like determined by all of these societal factors?"
Why does Kevin have it all? And I don't.
It got to that.
Is the third one the one in which the family from Michigan like moved to LA? Okay, so that's a really interesting one because that's someone, that's a family that went from like a 4-bedroom home and packed up everything and moved into a 2-bedroom apartment in LA, and but I do want to say really quick that in terms of the gay couple, like, I can see that being like some deeply internalized, like, what were my parents' expectations of me? Like, I didn't do the.
And he talks about that.
And like, even if that's not what we see on television, like there could be, you know, different things there. Like, we don't know his history or whatever with that journey. But the family that downsized from Michigan to LA had such. A resounding, that's the first episode I watched because I accidentally watched it out of order, and that one fucked me up because that was straight up my mom having the job of knowing everything, knowing where everyone's shit is, and my brother and I being the laziest fucks and not like contributing at all, and my mom doing everything for everyone. And And then in the first one, like hearing the guys say, like, when I come home, I want the house to be clean, and like recalling fucking huge, huge arguments that my parents would get into when I was a kid about the house not being clean because of me and my fucking brother and my mom just like literally trying to do her best. And so a lot of those things, I also had like a very strong emotional reaction, Danielle, but I think mine was more seated less in myself and more like my experience growing up with my parents and their subsequent separation. And it was in a way cathartic to see that, but it was painful. It was really, really painful because I was there so many times and I did not contribute. And, you know, you can't help but to feel as a child of like divorce, like there's all sorts of feelings of like guilt and like, what could I have done and what did I do wrong and how could I have like made their shit work? And so the emotional, I was sobbing every episode, all episodes.
Well, I saw the episode that's about a spouse putting away the clothes of like their recently passed.
Oh, yeah, that one was, that was other. Yeah, that was the second one I watched. That one was really
having gone through that process with, my mother 5 years ago. Like, I was like, at some point I'll watch this. I was like, oh, that's the episode when I've like, I'm done drinking for the night. I don't want to go to bed yet. I need to be in like a specific place to watch this where I'm just like ready to just like lose my mind. And like, yeah. And it'll be cathartic. Like it'll be cathartic to watch someone else go through like a deeply painful emotional process that I helped my mother and my family go through. And we did that ourselves years ago. And the first one with the couple was interesting too, because like they were portraying a very like typical gender dynamic in which it is often so much of like the housework is put on, you know, the woman that's staying at home that is both taking care of the kids and taking care of the house. And like that specific conversation they were having about like, oh, well, when the father would come home and like he'd point out like, well, why isn't this taken care of? You know, the subtext being like, you were home all day. And so in my relationship with my wife, like we have the reverse of that. So like I'm at home. I am like took a larger share of the caretaking with our child. I'm also, I work from home. So like I'm doing a lot of the cleaning of the house and like tidying. Like I don't turn off the annoying Apple Watch, like remind you to stand every hour, because I use that as a reminder to just like get up and just go do something around the house for a couple of minutes. So it's like I'll fold laundry or I'll do some dishes. And like that's just like a thing that gets me up and doing stuff. But like I remember when right after we had our kid, and like we would have those moments where my wife would be like, well, how did this get done? And like she wouldn't say like you were home all day, but like that was the message that was coming across. And it was kind of like, ma'am, I had X, you know, I worked today. I just have, you know what I mean? It's like it was fine. We worked through all that stuff. And communicated our way through like what is my relationship to the house. Like the other thing what happened with me is like because I'm home, I see all the flaws in the house, the things that we haven't done, and it bothers me so much more than it bothers her, right? So it's like we have done so little. The house is very clean. We don't have that much clutter. Like when I moved to San Francisco originally, I just got in a mentality of like I just don't keep shit. Like I just throw stuff out all the time. So we're very tidy in that regard. But we have barely put up anything in the house in terms of like pictures and posters. And it drives me up a wall. Like, we've been here for 2 years. How have we not found the time to do this? And she comes home. She's been at work all day. She just wants to come home and have a glass of wine. Not worry about the fact that like the guest room doesn't have anything. It just has a couple of nails in the wall where I'm like, you know, we really got to come up with a plan to like deal with these rooms and like figure out how we're going to do this. And she's like, nah, like this is the last thing I want to think about. Like we're gonna have this house for 30 years. Like we got a big loan. So like that's the flip side for me, where my relationship with our house is so different because I stare at the stuff we haven't done all day, and it bothers me.
Danielle, I think you have to go take a certification course in life-saving
emergency
medicine. New York
State EMT refresher exam for the next 3 years, so I can go into other people's houses and deal with their emergencies, basically. But this has been fun, Marie Kondo. I'm sorry I hate your show so much, but you're lovely. Those are my closing words. You can find me at Twitter at DanielleRI, where I will sob tweet about the show now, not with subtweeting. Bye, everybody.
Adios.
Bye.
One thing I'm curious about for all y'all is I've like read some sort of like characterization of like how Marie as a character is inserted into the show. And I think the show does a good job of not like sort of like othering her or being like it's weird because like that's part of her personality, right? Like it's part of her shtick is that she's sort of like a magic fairy that comes in and like helps fix your house.
I mean, I don't want to call it I think it is like I don't want. Like, there have been a lot of conversations on the internet recently that have been super fetishizing, super exoticizing, like, have positioned Marie, like any sort of positioning her in this, like, sort of fairy, fairy way, I think is...
The show certainly edits in a
way. It definitely edits because it is made for like an American audience, and right. Well, like when she, you know, she does this thing where when she comes into the house, she like likes to greet the house by and thanking it for letting her come in by sitting she kneels in the traditional like formal Japanese way of like respect, and she like bows to, she like takes a moment of you know silence and then bows to the house, which is a like in
traditional Japanese culture is like a very, very respectful, you know, act, an act of respect. And so one of my biggest frustrations is like that, the characterization of her as this sort of like magical fairy, because she is a person, and she has, it is her, that is like her, I don't know how to say this, like, it's her way of being. I guess
what I'm like trying to work through in the show is like, how much is her brand and how much is like the lens of American culture and editing her in a certain way, because like, I mean, it's her show, right? So, like, we have no idea. Like,
she's an executive. She's an executive producer on the show, but yeah, when she's doing that kneeling thing, there's like very like serene music that like plays in the background when she like does this greeting, and that shit feels like, okay, this is like the like super, and then it pans to like everyone watching her. She like invites some people to like do it with her, like take a moment to do it with her. In the first episode, she, you know, asks the couple to like take a moment to do it as well, and you see them like kind of become emotional. But it is just like, it is her way. And in the, I haven't read the book in a long time, and I don't know, and I haven't finished it, so I don't know how much of this is actually in her books as well. But it's, but this is the first time that we're seeing this, right? So I do wonder how, like, what the editing does, but I do think it is just like fundamental. It has to do with like her conceptions of like objects and material things, like having like spiritual value, which I. Yeah, that's like her conception, and is a conception. Like it is not a conception that Americans typically have with material items, and yeah, so,
or at least that they're not conscious of. Again, there's that element of just consider. Like, there is this aspect of she is giving people a framework to look at their possessions and their lives from a different angle. And I think what, something I do like in the show is that I think there's a, it would have been very easy to, for the show to like really lean into exoticizing, but there's frequent places where she is allowed to sort of like give her take on what she is seeing, what she's encountering. Like, there is such a good scene in the first episode, where the mom is standing in their newly cleaned kitchen, and she's like telling Marie, pardon?
She's beaming.
Yeah, and she's telling Marie, yeah, you know, he just, my husband, he was saying to me the other day, like, you know, this cleaning stuff is sexy. You know, it's and he's the neat freak in the relationship. He is the one who like looks around their house, and all he sees is the ways it is deficient and a disorganized, chaotic hellhole, and it stresses him the hell out. And so, you know, here comes Marie a couple days later, and you know, the wife in this pairing is saying, you know, he says it's sexy, this cleaning, this organizing, and Marie gives this look, she just like closes her eye, and basically she just cringes, basically. And it's just, she just says, like, really noncommittally, that is a very American way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And I think that was useful insofar as, I don't think that was just about like a, I don't think that's just a comment on like two different cultures. I think there was an aspect of Marie Kondo also being given a space to voice like her view of the dynamic she sees, the ways people relate to their spaces, their possessions, to each other, the way that stuff comes across to her. She is not just here to, this is not just, she comes in
that goes
and,
beyond
like,
just the instructional
away.
Stuff of like, here's what you do with your drawer when you pull it out.
Yeah.
And I wish the show did more to sort of humanize her. You get little bits and pieces of it, you know, like in that same first episode, there's the moment when they're in the garage and they're going through the wedding photos, and they're talking about an anniversary, and then, you know, she mentions that she's here shooting this on her anniversary,
I was sobbing.
Away from her husband. And, you know, again, I've only watched three episodes, and the show is not about, like, the emotional journey of Marie Kondo, but I think part of my concern, wonder about, like, you know, brand personality approach is, like, I think that could have been mitigated a little bit if there was a little bit more of her in the show. There's also the language barrier. You know, I mean, there are all sorts of considerations for why you don't get more of that. But I find the show to be, like, edited very strangely in a way that the show doesn't really – often feels like it doesn't know what kind of show it is.
Like,
is this a show about Marie coming in – commenting, is it about the families? Is it about Marie? What is the relationship between those two things? It shifts from episode to episode based on whatever seems to be the stronger arc between the two, but it loses her often.
Yeah.
And often not necessarily, and often necessarily just in favor of, like, better characters, right? Like the queer couple, they're really compelling characters and have a lot to say and to contribute to the overall theme. But, you know, she's really lost in that episode quite often.
Yeah.
And that just seems to happen over and over as probably, I mean, reality shows have hundreds of hours of shooting. So, like, they're making deliberate editing choices that unfortunately sort of bury her in what she has to say often.
Mm-hmm. Maria, first of all, man, she crushes it with kids, though. God damn.
Every time that kid wanted to leap into her arms, I was
so
dying.
Cute.
Damn, like,
great.
As someone,
when the 2-year-old says boobies,
there's so many good moments in that first episode. That first episode is choice, but I also think there's something. It was like that moment in the garage is really sad because, like, this whole, again, considering your relationship to objects and such, like, Marie is finding all this, like, detritus from their wedding and the earlier days of their relationship and, like, sort of these mementos of, like, their happiness and their relationship just sort of tossed into the garage. And, like, it was kind of a kind of upsetting sequence as Marie recognizes, like, these are important things. It is, like, she marvels at them. She loves, like, she thinks they're sweet photos. It's very sweet they have these. But also, she's kind of pointing out that, like, hey, this is stuff that shouldn't
just
be.
Yeah, what are these doing here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why are these behind the fucking golf clubs, basically? And I don't know. It was a sort of a really great moment. Because I think in a lot of the takes that have come out about this show, there's a lot of exaggerations about the advice that Kondo gives that people people are acting as if Kondo's marching orders basically are to burn your possessions. Like, there's the whole, you know, book lovers backlash of just taking umbrage at the idea that Marie Kondo thinks you should limit your library size, which, you know, honestly, probably a good idea. But also the notion that she just encourages you to just purge your stuff. No, she encourages you to get rid of things that you no longer have a, like, positive
attachment
connection
to.
With.
Yeah.
And I think what was great in that episode is that it's an example of, she's not just a minimalist coming in here and say, get rid of stuff. She's just pointing out that there are things about the things we own that reveal things about us that we have relationships to. And I thought it was a really great moment about her uncovering kind of an uncomfortable fact of a dynamic in that relationship that's opened up, where this is a couple that both literally and metaphorically has kind of cast aside a lot of memories and understandings of why they're together in the first place.
Well, they tap into, I think, a thing that any parenting couple can eminently relate to, is just how much you put aside yourself the moment you become a parent, because there really is no time. And, like, with that episode, like, by virtue of, like, going through the objects and, like, forcing them to reexamine that, like, smartly uncovers something that parenting couples know very well, but, you know, it's nice to see some wider exposure and, like, how, not that you should feel bad that people chose to become parents, like, this is, you know, a choice people often make, but just how little time you give to yourself in that process and how a relationship can deteriorate as a result. And by Marie coming in and giving a hierarchy to, like, your objects, like, I mean, it's really interesting. There was a comment from the wife when she was going through this whole process where she said, we should have these wedding photos out so that when we have a fight, we're reminded of like why we started doing this shit in the first place. Mm-hmm. When you're drowning and two kids screaming and running around and you want to, you know, strangle each other. Like that's the power of an object, which like gets to the core of like Marie's philosophy is like, you can have all the stuff. It's just a hierarchy to it. It's a priority system and prioritizing the stuff that has meaning to you. And the idea of like having, you know, not necessarily happiness, but just things that are imbued with power and meaning that are like closely accessible. I think, I don't, again, as someone that doesn't have a ton of stuff, but I certainly came away thinking like, yeah, that's like, right. Like there are things I have buried away that whenever I go through that drawer, I'm like, wow, that means a lot to me. I wish I could see that more often. And, you know, I'll probably hopefully go through and find some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Last thing I want to just sort of raise here is there have been a lot of different versions of this line of critique on the KonMari method. But a listener sent in an article from The Atlantic, Marie Kondo and the Privilege of Clutter. But basically it is examining sort of the KonMari method through the experience of, say, immigrants. People who have had to leave their old home and start anew somewhere else. And the idea of it is very easy to say, like, simplify your life, purge your possessions if you haven't had to abandon a great deal in the past, if you haven't lost a great deal in the past. But that is a much harder and more complicated ask if you're making it of families who in their experience across generations have had to forcibly say goodbye to a lot of things that they had like powerful and meaningful connections to. And also the great importance that old possessions and mementos start to form within families like that. I thought it was a good point to raise. I'm not necessarily sure that Marie Kondo would disagree with it, but certainly the way her method is being applied would seem to fit with that line of criticism. But I thought that was an interesting point, and I'm curious what y'all made of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a moment of that, but about, you know, cultural ties and things like that when in the episode, this is not one that I think y'all watched, but there is an episode I believe she, sorry, edit this out, Kato. Hold on. I want to get this right because I don't want to get this wrong. Was she Pakistani? Sunita. Then there's an episode of. Yeah, sorry. Okay. Here we go, Kato. Where in the episode where there's a biracial couple and the Marie finds a bunch of shawls of the wife is Pakistani, and she finds a bunch of like her Pakistani shawls in a dresser in her son's closet and is like, do these bring you joy? And then there's this moment where she's talking, her name's Sunita, about, you know, the fact that she lives in an area where there is not a large Pakistani community and these are her cultural ties. And I do think Marie does adjust for that. I mean, she's not saying, you know, like there's not a moment to showcase that adjustment. She does keep her shawls, and there's not a moment where Marie is like, culture, like that's not in her method. She doesn't talk about, she talks about sentimental objects. And if you have sentimental objects that you feel are important to you, keep them. But I do agree that the KonMari method or whatever, minimalism as a which is separate from the KonMari method, but shares some similarities, is, you know, my mom was an immigrant. She migrated to this country when she was 17, and I feel like that informs, she came with nothing, and she, that informs a lot of her mentality when it comes to holding on to things. She has like tons of like random Guatemalan things around the house that, like, to anyone else they're junk, but to her they're like precious items. And in all the other things, like I said before, like making sure that if a light bulb goes out, that we have more, that if, you know, if anything happens in emergency, like it is a very like sort of like survivor perspective to take to items, in the sense that like I need all these for like in case shit hits the fan and it's like apocalypse time, you know, like if so I think it's complicated, and I would hesitate to say that Kondo is like critiquing any of those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. I just don't think she's ever had to account for them, because that's not her background. Her background is like helping like families, presumably wealthy, probably. I don't know.
Who hires
a consultant? Like, you know, that have the ability to hire her. I don't know what her like day rate is or whatever, but like my guess is that this is like, these aren't things that she's like confronted before, and that's where you see like adjustments in her method. That's where you see, like, you know, when the woman who lost her husband, the recent widow, wants to do the sentimental objects first. She wants to deal with her husband's items first. And Marie Kondo always says, you know, like, do those last, because by then you've like fine-tuned the skill of like being able to separate objects and to identify joy and all those things. You've refined it so much that it'll be an easier process. But she allows her. She's not chiding her or shaming her. And I think like the exaggeration of like memes on the internet has like made this.
Yeah.
So like
she always comes across as just recommending, like, it's,
yeah,
it's,
these are like helpful, she's trying to be like these are like helpful suggestions.
She's never but an asshole about it,
but because it's like so it's tied to this like larger concept of like minimalism and things like that, like I think it brings up a lot of like really like important emotions of like, you know, this doesn't work for everyone. And it also like, yeah, I don't know. It's not just about like American consumerism. It's not just about like, you know, wealthy Americans like accumulating a lot of like stuff, and then, you know, the stuff is outdated, but they keep it because they don't think about it or whatever, like that carelessness. Like there's so much at play, and I just don't think she's had to account for that before, and so we're seeing it happen in real time through the show.
And even if you end up disagreeing with her method or some of the, like, you know, some of the consequences or unforeseen consequences, as you're pointing out, Natalie, I mean, what's useful about the existence of the method and then the usefulness of the existence of the show is like, it's a reason to like talk through that stuff, right? Like the existence of it is then leading to conversations about people's relationships to things, to objects, to what is otherwise, you know, to another person maybe considered junk, as you put it. And like, that's like really useful and insightful to see. Because it's not really like a conversation we have. You see other people's stuff. You may assume why they have X, Y, and Z. But, you know, the basic notion of the show of just articulating your relationship to an object is cool. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We will take a little break there. And I'll be back with the second waypoints of today's show. But first, maybe an ad. Maybe not.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
And we're back. Hopefully, whatever you heard sparked joy. But
oh boy.
In the meantime, yeah, who knows, right? Gosh, who knows what you just heard? Maybe
if
it was
not,
just a
think
little
it,
commercial jingle.
And cast it away.
Yeah. So my waypoint this week was an article by Claire Kellaway in Washington Monthly called How to Close the Democrats' Rural Gap, which is a title I don't love because it's not really about...
No, that piece has almost nothing to do with it.
No, it's not a how-to. Here's how we can turn, you know, Kansas blue or anything like that.
Right.
It's actually a much better piece that really starts digging into what has been happening in rural communities in the United States across the past, you know, 10, 20 years, and why there is such a growing crisis of poverty and lack of economic opportunity in rural areas, and why voters in a lot of those places do, with a great deal of justification, resent Democrats for that. And I thought it was a really good piece because it gives a decent survey of the problems facing rural communities, starting with farmers, but really rippling out to everyone who lives in these communities. And then also the way that a lot of policies that we do not think about or we do not pay attention to have contributed to increasingly desperate circumstances in these areas. And like, I was really taken aback by some of the stuff I was reading, and really kind of amazed by how much of this stuff has been allowed to happen in plain sight without anybody ever really acknowledging it as a problem. I guess the place where I would start is, and the central dilemma of this piece is that one of the major things that has happened to farmers since the 80s, certainly, but now it is worse than it has ever been, is that agricultural firms have consolidated to an unprecedented degree. Basically, in terms of agricultural products and supplies, you're looking at like three or four companies that effectively control that market. There's three or four countries that are selling seeds, that are selling fertilizer, other agricultural products. That's who controls the market. And then when it comes time to sell crops or livestock, once again, you have three or four firms dealing with these sort of raw agricultural outputs. And so on either end of this equation, farmers end up having to buy from a market that is basically highly oligopolistic and effectively controlled by three or four firms.
Yeah, it's a co-monopoly.
Yeah.
We all agreed to, we all are technically profiting from this separately. But, you know, I think there's a quote in there where they're like, well, yes, there are several companies I could go to argue prices, but when chances are they've gone behind our backs and already agreed to what the price is. And this happens like the airline industry all the time, when you like slowly see when one company decides to get the bad press and say, look, okay, we're gonna charge for, you know, baggage fees, right? Like that didn't used to be a thing, and then now it's a thing. It's like one person does it, everyone hates it, then they all do it, and that's because they've all collectively agreed, you know, and maybe not in a legal sense, but certainly right up to the line. And we hear about these things all the time in like goods that we have like a more personal relationship with. And I think what this article does like really well is illustrating and walking you through how you do have a personal relationship with this stuff, even if it's not like fully understood when you go to the store and, oh, the meat is 10 cents cheaper than, or 10 cents more expensive than it was 6 months ago.
I had a question.
Yeah.
Mm. So when I was reading this, there are people quoted from like farmers association, like national farmers associations and things like that. And something I was curious about is like, are farmers like unionized, or like do these associations even offer like legal protections, or are these, because I'm wondering like how the fuck did this happen? And like, is the association anything more than like a bigger voice?
So I am going to betray my ignorance here if I talk too much about that type of stuff. Like,
okay,
those things do not operate as unions. They operate, I believe, effectively as like lobbying groups. It's like far, like a farmer's chamber of commerce in some ways. Okay. But effectively, a lot of these things are, they're organizations that exist for regional farmers to bring their concerns and lobby on their behalf to like state governments, to federal governments. But like effectively, they are professional organizations that don't confirm any like meaningful material benefits, I don't think.
Well, and there are unions, but those unions are even getting screwed by are things that are not within their control, right? Like it's like there may be a unionization of a certain level of farmers, but what they're getting screwed by is the relationship to the consolidation of like seed manufacturers, right? In which like there's, you know, the bit of the piece where it's like it used to be that you would plant your crops and you could keep some of the seeds that come through those crops and then you would use that in the next harvest. And it's like now there are contractual relationships where these, you know, these like specifically designed seeds, because they're now an IP, like you can't save those, right? Like you can't save and use them. Like they're
Monsanto owns the copyright to those, like owns the patent to those seeds, and you cannot continue.
I think in some cases, some of the genetically modified crops will not even, like, you can grow the crop, but it's not going to produce a viable seed at the end of it. I think some of them, like, even that
by design
happening. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, the figure that really stunned me is that effectively, like, prices that farmers get at market haven't really changed
the bushel?
In 30
is
years.
Is this the bushel one?
Yeah, that was wild.
Yeah, they were selling for, like, what was it, three? Like,
I wrote it down. Quote, recently the president of the Nebraska Farmers Union, John Hansen, looked up the corn prices from 1973 when he started farming. That time he sold corn for $3.30 a bushel. In 2017, the average price per bushel was $3.33.
3 cents.
So it had gone up
3 cents
in a number of decades in which the cost of living has, you know,
40 years or more.
And the other figure being that in the 1980s, when American consumers spent a dollar on food, 37 cents out of that dollar went back to the farmer. Today, farmers receive less than 15 cents on every dollar.
You know, the margins have just been squeezed, and your ability to even negotiate along those margins has been squeezed even further because of the consolidation of your options.
Well, and every year, farmers are going into debt to purchase their year's inputs for the growing season. And then they are recouping that debt, hopefully, at harvest time when they sell their crops or livestock at market. So again, this is again like why farmers are being foreclosed on at staggering rates is because when you are basically like literally betting the farm every single year, which has always been a threat with farming, but particularly now that the rates are so controlled on either end, a lot of farmers are literally you know, just barely surviving each season. So the other part of this is like, how the hell did this happen? And one of the, there's a couple aspects here. One is that the government allowed the consolidation in the agricultural sectors to happen. You know, these mergers have to be approved. And there were a number of mergers of agricultural firms that probably should have raised some antitrust flags and brought in some antitrust protections to either prevent mergers or put conditions on them. And largely these things were rubber stamped. And so, you know, Washington basically signed off on this market structure coming into force for farmers. And then sort of this is, I guess, you know, this is an important part of like, where did the Democrats come into the story? Well, memorably, Obama made this a campaign issue in 2008.
This paragraph, like these two paragraphs gutted me, Rob. Like just, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obama makes this a campaign issue in 2008. You know, going back to the primaries where he really does need these rural votes, but he's listening to farmers and he's saying that, you know, there will be under his administration, they're going to push back against the takeover of corporate farming. And somewhat true to his word, when he took office, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack and the USDA proposed a bunch of regulatory changes to address a lot of the things that farmers were telling them. And
specifically, like this is mentioned later, where like they got a bunch of farmers to come out and name names, mm-hmm. like name specific problems they were encountering, kinds of things that when said publicly, like, you know, easy to imagine backlash happening under, you know, above the table or below the table as a result of coming clean about the problems in the industry.
And agriculture lobby rallied a lot of opposition on both sides of the aisle on Capitol Hill. And Vilsack and Obama just didn't, they still could have pushed these changes through. It's a regulatory change by the USDA that didn't need congressional approval. They could have put these rules into place. They just didn't. And then 2010 happens. The GOP gets a majority and begins enacting more measures to defend major agricultural firms' interests.
Well, then in 2010, Republicans took the House and began passing appropriations riders that stripped the USDA of the necessary funds to implement the rules, even if they had gone into effect.
Yeah. But here's the other part of this. Tom Vilsack is now working as the head, the CEO of a massive dairying lobby group that represents major agricultural product firms. And so from the perspective of a lot of people living in rural America, like, it's pretty easy to see the degree to which you were sold out by both sides. But it's got to be especially galling to see that, like, the Democrats' agriculture secretary walked straight out of office and into the private sector where he's making millions of dollars from the people he was supposed to police, which happens all the fucking time. But again, this is kind of how we got to the place where we're at. And then sort of the final nail in this coffin for, you know, what people are or aren't doing for rural regions is this notion that every time, like, center-left parties address things like rural poverty or economic issues.
No, I believe, Rob, they're called left behind,
right.
You know, areas.
It's all
left behind.
It's always in this way.
Like, there's so much to unpack from that term. Like, left behind presumes there's nothing left.
That they are behind.
There.
Like, in.
Right.
Like,
who left them behind, right? And then, like, yeah, that the proposals from center left, like, think tanks are, maybe they just fucking need some
internet.
Give them some high speed internet and coding classes.
Yeah. Farmers learn to code. Yeah. That's, like, that is the message being put out by a lot of supposedly progressive think tanks. This is a lot of what policymakers are imagining as the future for rural communities, and it's, like, deeply condescending and doesn't react to any of the degree to which rural communities were, like, they didn't just wither and die. They were killed by market forces.
They're being slowly strangled, basically. Like, they still exist. They're just, like, their bargaining power and weight is just a fraction of its former self. And, like, you know, the reason this story ended up getting the headline that it did is because of how it ties into, like, the larger question of the Democratic Party and how they appeal to, you know, I mean, the undercurrent of this is, like, well, how do you get people that probably voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump because they were like, well, fine, fuck the Democrats. Like, let's see if this guy goes and punches people in the nose. Is that, well, you know, the Electoral College is the fact that, like, you know, Democrats have funneled themselves into, you know, largely coastal areas and even in the states where they are redder. They're, you know, it's in these large blue cities and you're losing out on these whole rural areas. And policies like coding and high-speed internet, well, like, that just funnels people into the spaces that were already, like, essentially wasting votes. And so mm-hmm. it's this, like, larger meta problem of, like, how do you find more votes while also, you know, understanding that these people, like, they have been left behind. It's just the way that that's, you know, phrased in center-left think tanks is in a sense that there's no actual way of bringing them back, when actually the way of bringing them back is just bringing back, like, old school fucking, like, break up the companies, like, strip the monopolies. Like, you know, it's the kinds of things that people voted for in Trump, but yet actually is, like, much more part of the Democratic wing. They've just gotten away with it or gotten away from it for decades now.
Yeah. I mean, like, Democrats have, like, are deeply implicated in a lot of these evolutions of, you know, of the agriculture sector. Something else that this reminded me of is I think a couple months ago at this point, Washington Post published a really good piece by a dairy farmer from Wisconsin, Jim Goodman, retiring, explaining why he's retiring this year and why he sold his herd and why he's just bailing out of the market. And it's a bleak piece, but I think one of the other eye-opening things here is that this is a guy who survived earlier disruptions in farming in part by becoming an organic milk producer.
Get on the trend.
Well, right. And he said this actually helped farmers in a lot of spaces because when non-GMO, when organic foods started to become a trend, when it started to become something that people were interested in, a lot of farmers were ready, willing, and able to adapt to that, both because like that's the kind of farming and like practices a lot of them prefer to be doing because it is easier on animals, it is easier on your land, but also it did provide better prices. It was like it was a place you could go and you could differentiate your product and command a higher price for it. And then you list two things that happened. One is that big agriculture companies saw that market and they came in and started to dominate it. But the other way they did it was they just like encouraged defining every standard downward so that it effectively became meaningless. So like, for instance, probably 15, 20 years ago, maybe like buying cage-free eggs meant something. Almost mm-hmm. certainly something claiming to be cage-free at this point is probably a meaningless statement in terms of what conditions that actually reflects for the animals involved. And that is something that has happened across every product, every sector, this idea that, oh, people want to live more sustainably, like consume more ethically. Great. Let's lower the standards for what any of the product like stickers we put on this, like any of the certification for it. Let's make those standards as low as possible so we can effectively do the same shit we've always done and then sell it to you for a buck more per unit.
Yeah.
Well, and that's mentioned earlier in the piece of like sort of like the trickle down effect of all of these problems is that, well, because the monopolies have, you know, reduced the bargaining power on the part of farmers, it's reduced the margins. Well, once you've reduced the margins, you have to find efficiencies. Yep. How do you find efficiencies? And you find efficiencies through cramming more animals closer together. Like, so you end up, you don't think that, oh, if there's only a handful of companies selling seeds, like, what does that have to do with the ethical treatment of animals, right? Like, but all of that stuff trickles down in these ways that just, you know, I think part of what I found so powerful with the piece is that it articulates it, right? Like, I think you could say, like, generally, you know, like, oh, should we have more competition? Like, yeah, like, that is a democratic line. There should be more competition. But it's like, this piece breaks down specifically from a farmer to a consumer why you should feel uncomfortable with, like, the lack of competition. Like, it articulates very specifically, like, even if you're not a farmer, well, shit, you probably care about how those, you know, chickens or cows are packed together, right? Like that's what you keep liking on Facebook, right? And you know, I've never really heard a politician articulate specifically my personal relationship with these monopolies. And I think that's like the big, like, right, that has to be some part of this pivot that will hopefully will come in 2020 is like specifically articulating to people, what is your relationship to monopolies? Like the easy one is like, ah, man, you only get to sign up for Comcast, right? And like, but it's like, it's everywhere. Like the lack of competition, the monopolistic nature of American capitalism is everywhere. But it's just nobody's articulating how it affects you and how it affects your values, right? So like that goes from, for a farmer, it's how it impacts the bottom line. For the average person, it's like, well, how does this impact your values? And I think like the average person, they'd respond to those questions, be like, yeah, fuck them. Like break them up.
Yeah. One of the most terrifying things reading that second article about the dairy farmer retiring was in the last paragraph when he talks about, or the second to last paragraph when he talks about, you know, quote, despite this, I hung on, but I couldn't continue milking cows indefinitely. Perhaps it's for the best. A few years before we sold our herd, we had to install huge fans in our barn. The summers were getting too hot for the cows to be out during the heat of the day. Climate change would have made our future in farming that much harder. We could have adapted, I think, but we ran out of time. And that to me is like another, like, who can afford like to adjust to climate change? Like in thinking about, you know, like small time farmers like already operating at debts and in you know, negative numbers, and then with, you know, the impact of climate change, meaning, you know, huge spending on adjustments, like it's just like it's completely unsustainable. And can breaking up monopolies even like I like it has to be better, but I worry that
it doesn't change it overnight, right? It becomes a generational shift.
Yeah,
like it's like you can break them all up
but
right
in
now,
50
but
years, who fucking knows what the earth looks like? Like, who knows what agriculture is like in 50 years? Maybe we're all operating out of greenhouses. Like,
it's such a chilling detail because, like, this is Wisconsin, and cows can't be out during the day in the summer on a lot of days. Like, that is a terrifying detail because, like, that's a pretty northerly latitude. That's pretty temperate. And already this is becoming a major issue for farmers in Wisconsin. So that's happening today. What's it going to look like in 10 years, right? And exactly, how do you fix this? How do you make it look? How do you make this tenable? At the same time, I do look at that, and I also see another problem where almost certainly agriculture consolidation has made this worse, right? I mean, one of the major issues that one reason that major cattle herds produce so much methane is because they are fed corn. They are not supposed to eat corn, but so they end up producing a lot more methane because it doesn't sit right in their stomachs. And so basically, like, because corn is cheap, large agriculture firms feed cattle corn and basically give herds just enduring cases of indigestion, and it becomes a major driver of greenhouse emissions. Farmers, a lot of these agriculture products, a lot of these farming practices are incredibly hard on soil quality and water supply. And again, we kind of just look the other way while these companies sort of encourage what are ultimately unsustainable and destructive practices. And yeah, it's just a really eye-opening piece about, okay, well put this is, I think it's very easy from the remove of a city to just think about, this has been happening for 30 years, as long as I've been alive, basically, things have been getting harder for farmers. I think it's very easy for me, certainly, to look at that as like, yeah, it's agriculture in a post-industrial age. Like, of course things are getting harder. I'm sure that's just a natural market force that is at work. And a piece like this is really good, like pointing out there is a design here. Like,
yeah. You're not wrong, but you're wrong for all sorts of other different reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, shit, the line that really chilled me was one large dairy co-op in the Northwest or Northeast sent its members a list of suicide and mental health hotlines along with their dairy checks.
Yeah, these are populations that are increasingly afflicted by opioid epidemics and also higher suicide rates.
Yeah.
Like, things are fucking dismal. Like, they're super grim, and there's no
hope on the horizon, right? Like, you're sending those with the checks because, you know, there's less money to go around, and also, like,
there's no mental,
it's
yeah.
not like it's gonna get better tomorrow.
There's no mental health care, universal, like, healthcare that's going to serve these communities in terms of, like, we in the United States, we have a problem with how we address, like, drug crises, you know, like, it's from, like, all fucking sides, and that's why it feels so devastating, because it's like you're just getting hit from everywhere.
So anyway, I thought that was a really good piece, a good, like, sort of first look at what has happened in rural places. And this is a space that I don't think our politics and our discourse have done a great job of addressing or even comprehending. And
it's not just what's encouraging about this piece, and why I would echo people reading it. It's not just, like, I love hearing, I'm interested in hearing, I don't love hearing, I'm fascinated by and we're drawn to like individual stories of hardship and people having to deal with crushing loss or having to move on from their careers. But like, this article is very good. It's not just a pull at your heartstrings. It's like a brass tacks, like policy wise, mm-hmm. in a very readable fashion, like what's fucked up about what we've let go wrong. And so, you know, like the Washington Post piece, you know, that you linked about, you know, the now former farmer, like I enjoy reading those too. That is a certain window into, but I often leave those pieces going like, okay, what do I do about this? Right? Like, who am I voting for? Like, you know, this is a piece where it's like, okay, I'm now thinking X, Y, and Z as I'm watching, you know, the 2020 primaries, like kick into gear. Like, this gives me like actionable things to be like, okay, these are things I want to know from the candidates. Whereas like those pieces give us a slice of life and they are informative, but I often find them to be empty calories because it's something to share on Facebook and it is interesting. But like, this is something where it's like, okay, I came away from this piece like with three bullet points that I'm thinking about when, you know, Kamala Harris and others are saying that we're gonna fix things. And I'm the one that can speak to, you know, when Beto's like, I can speak the rule of order. I'm like, okay, well, what the fuck does that mean? And how does that address, even if you're not necessarily farming is your talking point, you know, this is just one of many different areas in which policy changes would ripple, you know, into other areas.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? Often these are portrayed as cultural issues. Oh, I can talk to rural voters. I can relate to them.
Yeah, that's like this, a cultural disconnect.
Yeah, and this is like, it may not be, and probably frequently is not, an issue of culture. It is that what you have to say doesn't actually speak to any of their realities, and it does not inspire anyone's trust or confidence that you're going to make their lives materially better. So that is definitely something to be listening to as we move toward what is sure to be a scintillating and delightful primary season.
Which we are. We've talked about that, you know, it's not like we're making like a regular feature, but like we want to try, like you, Rob, had pitched maybe doing a waypoint on an article about Kamala Harris's, you know, history as a prosecutor. And so I think that one of the things we're going to try and explore through Waypoint is, you know, as I'm sure everyone listening is thinking about that stuff and you're starting to try and process the backgrounds of a bunch of people that you only know through like glowing, shallow profiles in the political press. But, you know, I think that's something where we can start considering each of these candidates through these lenses, you know, as they begin to announce their runs.
All right, so we will leave it there for today. Our thanks to Too Mellow for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at twomellowmakes.bandcamp.com. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people keep up with you online?
At Patrick Lubbock.
Natalie.
At Natalie Watson, tidying my life.
All right, that'll do it for this week's Waypoints. We hope you've enjoyed the break. We'll be back again with a Friday Waypoint Radio that I was not on, but I heard was a great conversation with Adam Conover. So we hope you'll join us again for that. But until then, do not give in to astonishment.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more.
And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.